Mr. Sherwood, Reel 10. So you'd got as far as Benghazi, and what's the next stage as you moved into January
43? Well, January 43 were that much further advanced than Benghazi, and we were probably, at the very beginning of January, something like 50, 75 miles from Tripoli, which was, of course, the main target. And the beginning of 43 was, from my point of view, very exciting time, doing very interesting things, because around about the middle of January, we were told that we were going to go with the second New Zealand deal on a movement down into the desert and to come up at Tripoli with the intention of cutting off the Germans before they could retreat from Tripoli. And the preparation for that, remember, had to leave behind any unnecessary equipment, unnecessary men, any thin-skinned vehicles, taking for a certain amount of rations with us, and all that sort of thing, and going off at night through the desert, going into the desert. And there were things called Gerald's candles. That's precisely what they were. Maybe some sort of burnout or battery, whatever, because the sappers would go in ahead, go ahead, trying to clear the mines, and then we tried to follow the candles or whatever they would let. So then we travelled. One way of keeping in mind was that on the rear differential, the coloured lorries, they'd be painted white. You'd have a minimum of light going from the oncoming vehicle, so you could just see that little white spot, and that's what we followed. And we went down into the desert and did the social movement, but of course, by the time we got to Tripoli, the Germans had gone, basically treated. That was a very exciting couple of days, and I remember also that I drove the first, heavy attack down into Tripoli. The Germans had left about 5 o'clock in the morning, and we went in about midday. I remember we were down, I think a place called Castel Franco Benito or something. It was in Aden also, about, I don't know, 30 miles south of Tripoli. There was quite a good road, like an equivalent, because they have a motorway, but it wasn't quite a motorway. But it was quite a good road. And we were told, get to Tripoli as quickly as you can. And we backed it along that road, and I was driving this Matador, I thought it was going to miss the opportunity, and drove right into Tripoli and took up position somewhere on the outskirts of Tripoli. Tripoli was a very attractive town. The Italians did quite a good job. They made it very attractive. One place to start was a thing called a Cantina Sociale, like a bodega, where wine was stored. Enormous vats, colossal things with wine, but before the Germans had left, they opened the vats and the wine would come out and was pouring down the streets. The streets were awash with wine, and of course we filled up the wine and they had quite a bit and filled it up. And then we went into what would in effect be a static site, because we knew we were going to be there for a while. There was quite a good room and stopped at one of the head of Tripoli. The Tripoli was quite a big prize. That was in effect the end of the war in Libya. Well, then the next stop, the next place, would be Tunisia. In Tripoli, a number of things happened. Was that where I met Mugambi?
What did you think of him?
He looked a bit insignificant. He looked like his pictures, his photographs, but I cannot say that he was a manly, pleasing-looking person. In fact, I remember that he gave the impression that in civilian life he would be perhaps something of a bigot, and perhaps not a nice person to know. But of course, these were vague thoughts at the back of one's mind. It was clear, presumably, that he was a brilliant military tactician, and to what extent the success after the Battle of Alamein was attributable to him personally, and how much to the fact that we had the equipment and that the Germans had such a lot of extended lines of communication that almost anybody perhaps would have been able to do it. I don't know. I can't say. But I often felt that Ottinger, I think, was unfairly dealt with. He was sent off and he was more or less blamed, I think. It was Ottinger who organised the defence of the thing at Alamein. And Montgomery wasn't going to be taken over. I think there was a chap named Gott, I think, who was said to take over. He was killed in a plane crash. I think Montgomery was a second choice.
Do you remember anything he said when you met him, Montgomery?
No, not really. So he didn't make any value to that. He was knocked them for 6 south of Europe. I think that was of North Africa. I think that was, or something, that was a phrase he liked to use, knocked them for 6. But no, I don't know. And also, it would have been only a momentary thing, and the other people would have, I'm sure. By the time he left the site, he had no recollection of having met me. It was just another face of having the other young officers.
So you set up a long-term base.
Well, we didn't know, of course, it was going to be a long-term base. It stayed, so it was for quite a while. Quite a while. Now, in Tobruk, as I say, it was quite nicely developed. There was a hotel in Tripoli. There was a good hotel called the Grand Hotel, and offices there, and we went there. And I must say, it was the only time I did any sort of looting. There was a silver plated milk jug. It was a very pretty little thing. I thought, I must have some sort of souvenir of this. And I pocketed that. It was quite wrong. Maybe I left a bit of tip, but I'm not sure. And also, on the bottom of the jug was printed a stamp, Rubata Belgio. Grand Hotel, whatever he'd stolen from Grand Hotel. And I kept it. But the interesting also that about 2 years ago, back in Tripoli, went to the window and my wife, we went to the Grand Hotel, which had been completely rebuilt. It was quite different. And I thought, should I hand it back to them? But I thought, I'll keep it. Incidentally, it was very kind, because it didn't have any local, whatever the currency would have been. We wanted a coffee, because we'd gone with a coach thing from the boat.
Hang on, sticking to the original, not when you went back.
The original, yes. We had, it was very good, we had some good meals, we had the wines and all that. We used to pay in money called BMA. I think that was British Monetary Authority. It was like monopoly money. Looked very much like monopoly money. We didn't know then it was monopoly, but that was the sort of thing. And we paid with them, and then they were going to be honoured at some later date by the British authorities. It'd be the equivalent of our pay. We would be paid in this paper money, and we use that in what rate they honoured it afterwards, whether they honoured it, we never knew.
Were you doing much on the gun position at Tripoli? Were there many German attacks, or was it quiet?
There was quite a bit. There was quite a lot. Because that became, of course, one of our main sources of supply. Because they were very fourth in Tunisia, where we're going to be. But the next big one would be from Tripoli itself, and we'd go there to places like that. There were monasteries, perhaps, and all that, but there were apparently small.
Tunis itself, you were.
Tunis.
You were in Tripoli.
You were in Tripoli, but I'd say that we. we were going to advance into Tunisia. And between, and Tripoli was really about the last main entry, port of entry, before going right into Tunisia. The next port would be way up the coast. So Tripoli was very important. So on the one hand, we had to destroy it to prevent the Germans using it. Then when we went, you had to rebuild it, and the Germans then destroying it to prevent us using it. That sort of thing. It was a very big port, and I remember, oh, that was where also had these two-man submarines, the Italian two-man submarines coming in and blowing up. In fact, there was a thing on the radio recently about that. I don't know part of it, but that was...
You mentioned it before about...
Yes, it was a fire sort of thing when it was blowing up. It was in Alexandria it happened, but it also happened in Tripoli and Tripoli Italy. I have to say Tripoli Italy because there's Tripoli in Lebanon. So we say Tripoli Italy. Time in Tripoli was quite good. They were mostly Italians had gone. They were Arabs. Brussels. The Italians did a quite good job with their Brussels. And they used to have traveling Brussels, great big coaches, brilliant coaches were being converted, which had various rooms. And there, I think also, I mentioned this in relation to Egypt itself, you have the situation of queues waiting to go in to a brothel, they were taken over. And we said, well, I don't know if it's true, but that sort of 8 o'clock in the morning, the very senior officers, 10 o'clock in the morning, the more junior officers, and from midday till 3 o'clock or something, the NCOs, and then after that, the men, that sort of thing. But whether that's just the clock before, whether it actually happened, I don't know. But I know that's what we used to say. And then, of course, there was the usual thing, the medical questions of the ED and so on. What else about Tripoli? There wasn't a great deal to do. There was a nice place to walk along, the Corniche, wonderful palm trees. And it kind of shut down a good job. That really made it quite attractive. Roads were quite good. I remember a shocking accident. Some went in a jeep. They were Australians. But the Australians are notorious for causing more damage. So that the Australians caused more damage to Cairo than the Germans ever did. And we were out and trained there. A shocking loss from other points of view. And one jeep went straight flat into a big palm tree. And I remember seeing the driver then went to the somersaulted over to the barn. I think that was an Australian, but the Australians anyway were notorious at causing damage. And also, just harking back, in Cairo, I think a casualty rate. People coming out of nightclubs and falling over and hurting themselves were as much as happened in the desert at that time. There was a lot of that. Anyway, Tripoli was a good place to be.
How long were you there for?
I can't know exactly, but I can give you an idea. That was January. We had a big parade when Churchill came along and the King came, visited, and that must have been towards the end of January, early February, and we must have started moving up probably about early February, or mid-February would have been there, because only in March was the Battle of Narrowth, March the 6th, I think. So it would have been there about a month or so. There was that big parade when the King and Churchill were there. We might then go off into Tunisia. You can hardly tell, we wouldn't know that you were in Tunisia, no longer in Libya, because it's the same sort of desert. But then, except that when you came along, notices were in French instead of Italian. Incidentally, there's a door that's of interest. When we went to Tripoli recently, there was not a single sign in Italian. There was not a single thing to remind you that the Italians had been there for 1500 years. All completely eliminated. But in Tunisia, of course, French was the of Arabic was the main language, and everything was the French. And I remember having to give lessons, giving lessons to the men in a bit of French. I only had school French, but I knew a few bits. And I remember a father saying, we used to get on the signs of buildings, dépense d'affiché. Remember saying that? Which means stick no bills. Not that they must stick no bills. But they couldn't believe that these great big notices stretching sort of 10 yards or something said dépense d'affiché meant stick no bills. They assumed that dépense had something to do with defence and the war. They couldn't believe that. They said, no, you mustn't stick bills. But it quite a decent few words of the morning and all that. Because when, from a social point of view, when we got into Tunisia, and one of the earliest places, for instance, was under Medellin, outlined and then Monastir and so on, was that it was European, to a large extent, the French. French influence was very, very strong. French spoken, a lot of French, a lot of English, but not so much English in those days. And the girls would be dressed in Western style, and everything was white, so to speak. Previously, it was basically Arab women in the world before. No one had very, very much to do with them. But we socialised an enormous amount with the local French girls, women, young. We were only 23, I suppose, 22, 23. So my main interest would be girls about 20 or 19 or 18, 17. One big battle had to be fought first. That was the last, in effect, the final battle of the Alexander concerned. That was at the Marrick line. This was about 50 miles inside the frontier, a bit less perhaps, and it was built by the French to defend Tunisia against attack from the Italians. Again, you had something similar to the Alamein situation, where you had the Qatari depression, and then the Mediterranean. Here you had the Mediterranean, and then some higher ground and desert thing up to about less than 20, 30 miles. So those 20, 30 miles had lots of fortifications in them. And the Germans, I visited those again after the war. It was the same sort of thing. It often happened. The British found a way of bypassing and came up behind the Marrick line, and the Germans then had to retreat further north. And that was the end of the, say, reactional fighting. There was fighting. There was bombing, there was shelling. We were positioned basically on forward airfields all the way up. And also we were, to a large extent, sighted at various sort of ports on the way. Very attractive, very pleasant, green, filled with vegetables and all that would be plentiful, and cafes and all that. They hadn't been destroyed by them for that much. And we have a particular friend, Therese. She was a school teacher. Very, very friendly. And what we would do at times would take a few rations from our mess. We'd go there, our chocolates and things like that, and they went down very well because although there was not a vegetable belt, other items of food were very scarce. And it all went very, very nicely. When we were quite happy. It was quite a good war. There was some bombing and fighting, but nothing to speak of, nothing that worried us. And thereafter, all the way up, we didn't actually get sighted in Tunis itself. We went up to Sfax, Monastir, Kairouan. Kairouan is a place about 40 miles inland, and it's, as I understand, about the third holiest city in Islam. had bigger tourist gets now. And we were sighted there, while it was American, it was American air base. And also, it was the first time, became involved with American troops. For some reason or other, we were seconded to Americans for rations. Some units were going on just doing the ordinary bullies and cheese and that was all. And I remember going to have lunch at an office, American hospital, and I was absolutely amazed. I could not believe it. The amenities, the things they had, they were great big tents like a marquee. They had refrigerators, ice cream being served, all the goodies you could think of, and our rations had wonderful things, like what. Well, the African management or whatever, and the concerts that the American troops had, certainly were chiefly more the officers, but I think the men were comparable. We were amazed. We thought, I mean, they load their lorries up with refrigerators where they could put ammunition instead, that sort of thing. Maybe a bit of sour grapes, because the American had a tough time. For the first time in North Africa, in many ways, were much more difficult than more trouble than we did. The terrain was very difficult for them, and also the line between the cave and the Egypt. And then they got to Tunis, I think it must be in May. March, April, May, when Tunis fell. This SFL, I made a note, ring down the curtain, 8th Army out of work. Ring down the curtain, back to the Naval Exchange, 8th Army unemployed, or something like that. Although we assumed that we were going to go into Italy, but already, even before Tunis and things, there were excursions into Syria, into Sicily, and then further onwards into Italy. I remember the notes I made. We were told, yes, we were going to go into Italy, but then they were told, no, we're not. Our unit was going back to basement, Cairo, Egypt. Terribly disappointed. But we're looking back and then, why we should be disappointed? And so we were pleased with the opportunity. And that was the end, in effect, of. The active part in the war, the real active part. There was even when we went back to Alexandria for a short period of time, we were on a composition there, and I thought there was some shooting in the German carriage bomb Alexandria Harbour, but there was nothing to speak of. And thereafter, said it was a good war, it was a good war, it was pretending. We went back, partly by boat, I think, to. Alexandria, which is a long haul, about 1,500 miles. And then the question of what was going to happen. Some of us went to composition in Alexandria, but thereafter I was, I was very lucky, because I went to base depot, which was in Heliopolis, Cairo, and was hauled up for an interview because the Department of Technical Intelligence needed somebody to take over and deal with a particular section of it. My qualifications, academic qualifications, was in law. So why they picked on me, a lawyer, to go for that job, that was normal army. But fortunately, I had always been interested in engineering. Now the thing with the slide rules I've been trying to make, and
now, what was this thing with the slide rule? When had you been doing that?
Now, I did two. I realised there was twice.
And what were they?
The first one, it was that circular slide rule I think I told you about, which was in the early days of radar, when they were at Mark 1 star or something. For instance, when there was a problem about working out the height quickly. Today, it would be no problem. It's all automatic. But they're working out height. So what you have the range, the slant range, the ground range was the distance between your position and the vertically lower position of the aircraft. That would be the ground range. The slant range was the actual reading you get on the radar of the distance between you and the actual target. You'd also, because you had a thing called a goniometer, I think that was the difference between a Mark 1 and a Mark 1 star, which gave you some sort of an angle. Now, if you got the slant range and the angle, you could work out from trigonometry, should you remember, they work out different things. You can work out, is it like base over the hypotenuse is equal to the cosine of the angle of the we call it the angle of sight. And also, the I think it was made of hypotenuse over the perpendicular, was both the tangent, I think. Now, if you knew the angle, you knew the slant range, you knew the angle, the tangent, and the angle, you'd be able to work out the height of the plane. And so, as I mentioned, that with the particular, the height was the important thing, and so many things were based on the height at which the plane was flying. So I made this circular slide rule using, I think it was the back of the school, book I had, to get all the logarithms and the whatever, so that you could just, when the radar would call out range 50,000, whatever it was, and the angle, you would then move it round and read off immediately the height. And there was some interest earlier. And later, this was during the sometime in the desert going up the Advance, I made another one to do a similar sort of job, but that was a linear slide rule, so the circular. So with your circular, you get a much larger distance than on a straight thing. And it's easy to cast around and so on. But some interest was shown, but I think neither of them actually get into operation. I don't know, I don't think so, but I'm sure that much better equipment came out from England to do the same job much more quickly than I've seen like that.
But it may well have been this work that it attracted their attention to you.
Possible. But I went up for the interview and it was clear that I've always been fairly mechanically minded, and I got along well with them. There were two other officers there, Captain Bonner and Captain, and there was also a clerk named Diat. The real name was Deth, D-A-T-H, but they called it the apostrophe after the D-E, to make it Diat. And she was crazy. There was something mentally wrong with her, because one day she ran to the cupboard with the pistols, because they had loads of German.
Hang on, we're getting ahead. What about the interview? How did it go?
The interview went fine. I'm not quite sure I can't remember the precise details of how it went. But both the people were, I think they were both not really, they weren't regulars. And they were what we called officers and temporary gentlemen. And there was a difference, so maybe for that reason I got along more easily with them. And they were quite happy talking, and in fact, well, of course, you needed to be a bit mechanically minded if you did to do the job, but I could cope with that. Didn't have to be an absolute expert at that. And my job was dealing with enemy artillery.